Hello, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and you're listening to Sustainability Now, a bi-weekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. California is dry, 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 and that probably means we are in for a wild wildfire season. Since the beginning of January, there have been more than 10,000 wildfires across the state. So what are we to do? My guest today is Dr. Sasha Berlman, wildland fire scientist. Dr. Berlman earned her doctorate in wildland fire science from the University of California at Berkeley, conducting her graduate research in Northern California on prescribed fire use for restoration of ecosystem health. She is director of Fire Forward at Audubon Canyon Ranch in Stinson Beach. She is a California State Certified Burn Boss, a prescribed fire training exchange coach and leader, and a wildland firefighter with fire effects monitoring, squad boss, crew boss, firing boss, and incident commander qualifications. We're going to talk about wildfires. Dr. Sasha Berlman, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't we begin, as I always do, by talking about how you became a wildland fire scientist. It's a discipline that I think not many people know about. And I actually read about someone at UC Berkeley this morning in the San Francisco Chronicle, perhaps one of your advisors. So when did your interest in such fires begin, and how did you get into the field?
My interest in this field definitely started as a child. So I grew up in Temecula in Southern California, which is an area surrounded by chaparral covered hills. And wildfires were a big part of my experience as a child. I would, go outside my front door in the summer and catch white ash in my hand. We would have smoke days, but not snow days. And it was something that I thought about a lot as a child. I would have night terrors for a time there that I was trying to save my family from wildfire. So it had a big influence on me as a kid. But then of course, I grew up, I became a teenager. It was less of a thing for me for a while. And then I came to community college, and as part of the honors program for an environmental science class I was taking, I was told to go become a docent at a nature preserve in the area. And there, for the first time in my entire life, I learned about the positive role that fire plays in our ecosystems and the incredibly positive relationship people had with fire here for thousands of years. And it shocked me that that was something I was just finally learning about after all of those years of having only ever heard this terrible story about fire and the way it impacts us. And so I wanted to get involved and see what I could do to make a difference.
That's an interesting point that government policy beginning in the early part of the 20th century was to save trees in order to cut them down, and fires destroy them, right? And it's taken a long, long time to kind of realize that that's not always been the case. But we can come back to that in a minute. So you've got a lot of firefighting credentials. And I was wondering whether you were a firefighter before you got your PhD. What's your experience in the field?
So I started studying fire in school around the same time I started doing prescribed burning through the Nature Conservancy as a volunteer. So I kind of dived into it full force, trying to get my hands on actual prescribed fire tactics and involved in that community while studying it in my undergraduate once I transferred to UC Berkeley. But it wasn't until after I completed my PhD that I finally got out on my first wildfire assignments through the Redding Interagency Hotshot Crew.
Where was that?
So the Redding Interagency Hotshot Crew is based out of Redding in California. And I joined them for a significant part of their 2017 season. I got out on the fire line with them and then came back for the full season in 2018. And have continued to detail them whenever I can since then.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about what the experience of fighting a fire is like.
I I absolutely love being on the hotshot crew. I love the people and the chance to see places that you would never otherwise see. It's really an incredibly rewarding and positive experience. And I also just love hard work. So it was really great getting out there day after day with your closest friends over the summer and doing some really good hard work.
Did you ever think about, or do you think about going into an academic career at some point after
I
all of this?
don't,
No.
that's never been part of my trajectory. I kind of fell into the PhD as a way of making sure that before I went into active management, I had the knowledge and skills that I needed on that academic side to really back up the actions I would take on the ground.
And so what do all of those credentials mean?
So, are you referring to
Well,
like,
I have you're a state certified burn boss, a prescribed fire training exchange coach and leader, a wildland firefighter with fire effects monitoring squad boss, crew boss, firing boss, and incident commander qualifications. I mean, it sounds military, to be honest.
yeah, I mean, because of the way that we've dealt with fire in the last 150 years, the main industry around fire suppression is very paramilitary. So you're right about that. So most of those qualifications are part of the federal national wildland firefighting or wildfire coordinating group is the official term for it. That basically lines out the different qualifications people can have in firefighting. So fire effects monitor is kind of the prescribed fire bent of those. So it's focusing on the effects of the prescribed fire that you're laying down most of the time. But then, squad boss and incident commander, crew boss, firing boss, all of those are different positions that allow you to take action on the fire line. And they're used in both wildland firefighting and in a lot of prescribed burning these days.
Okay.
But yeah, I'll stop there.
Well, no, and I mean, do you then, are you head of a particular crew? Do you command a crew, or are you just a member then? With you know, I since I don't know exactly what the credentials mean.
Yeah, so I use those credentials when I go out on a wildfire or when I'm leading a prescribed burn and or a group of people on a prescribed burn. So we've done a lot of prescribed burns here where myself and my team organize as the leadership will be the crew boss and the squad bosses for teams of community members who are coming out to prescribed burns so that they have safe and effective leadership to allow them to operate on the fire line.
So I mentioned earlier about federal and state policy, and all of these agencies that are involved in forestry, land management, fire control, wildlife conservation. We're really all created during the conservationist progressive era, right? Which is the beginning of the 20th century, right? And all organized essentially around conservation, in the sense of preserving biodiversity for lumber and for hunters and for, capitalist production, right? But that's begun to change over the past 40 or 50 years. To what degree do you find that that has changed in, let's say the places that you move through?
I would say that conservationist era, as you describe it, that it really focused on protection in the sense that like people are separate from these, but we utilize these things. So we need to keep people off of them and away from them so that we can therefore extract these things from the land when it's convenient for us. And I think we're moving now into, or where we're headed towards is a stewardship culture. That people are an integrated part of these systems. These systems are adapted to people tending them and in a very thoughtful and integrated and meaningful way for long duration. And we need to go back to a version of that that then also takes on awareness of impacts like climate change and the structures that we have on the landscape now and invasive species. So bringing into focus a stewardship model is really the way forward.
Do you find that the sort of conservationist view is still very strong, or or is it changing?
I think it's changing, and I think it's changing pretty rapidly. It's present. It's not gone. It's definitely a part of a big subset of community, but I think we're learning and progressing from that into something new.
I mean, the reason I ask is a few weeks ago, I interviewed Suzanne Simard, who was a professor up at the University of British Columbia and studies, you might say, the social life of trees. But she was, worked in forestry and in timber before she went into the academy and talks about and writes about this sort of conservationist attitude towards lumbering and then replanting. And she suggested that although the view is changing, you know, it's still sort of deeply embedded in the agencies. Contrary to how, well, I imagine you weren't brought up that way. I certainly was brought up, you know, with Smokey the Bear and all of that kind of stuff. So that's what I'm curious about. And your colleagues on the you know, fire line, are they, do you see them also sort of adopting this new culture?
I would agree with her that the conservationist mindset is definitely deeply embedded in our agencies, in our structures, in our policy, in all of these things. I have the huge, I guess I could call it luck, that in the program that I direct, Fire Forward, I'm working with a general public audience of community members who are not mm-hmm. deeply embedded in any agency mm-hmm. and have not been brought up or restricted to these existing conservationist structures. So we're able to really have a grassroots movement where we're able to take on this stewardship culture right now and start showing what can be done when we take on that mindset. So I've been really lucky to surround myself with that in most of the work that I do. But definitely there's so much work to still be done when it comes to actually undoing and disentangling some of these conservationist outcomes that have impacted the way we can do things on especially federal land or through state agencies, things mm-hmm. like that.
I mean, the other sort of deeply held belief is the protection of property at all costs, at virtually all costs, right? Which again, yes. is sort of very foundational to our society. Right. And that, of course, comes into, well, that's the whole debate over building in the at the urban suburban fire forest interface. Right. And, you know, what's society's responsibility to people who build in high risk zones? We have that going on here at UC Santa Cruz. So let's take a break and we'll come back and continue our conversation. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM on your radio dial and KSQD.org streaming on the internet. Good afternoon. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz. Today, my guest is Dr. Sasha Berlman, wildland fire scientist. Dr. Berlman earned her PhD in wildland fire science from the University of California at Berkeley. She's currently director of Fire Forward at Audubon Canyon Ranch in Stinson Beach. Okay. Well, let's shift for a moment and talk about forest ecology and the role of fire in sustaining the forest, right? And this kind of the tension we were just talking about. Why is fire so important to forest sustainability? Let's put it that way. And maybe you can also talk about how California's Native Americans, you know, used fire to manage forests.
Yeah, I mean, all of our landscapes in California have been significantly impacted by fire for thousands of years as a tool in the landscape, cleaning up these forests essentially. And in most of California, outside of the Sierras or the very northern part of California, Eastern Sierras, a lot of California was managed through use of fire by indigenous peoples, and it continues to be still today in many parts of California. That's not a thing of the past. So essentially the frequent use of low to moderate intensity fire in a lot of our forests allows the bigger, healthier trees to survive through their ecological adaptations, biological adaptations to fire, having thick bark or resprouting abilities, or having their canopy held really high above the surface of the landscape. So all of these adaptations allow low intensity or moderate intensity fire to move through that forest or woodland understory at moderate to low intensity, and then consume the dead material and leave those healthy trees intact. And that allows for fewer total trees on the landscape, but you're basically removing those unhealthy trees that can't thrive in that situation, and selecting for just the trees that are going to be resilient in the face of more fire and climate change and drought stress and pathogens. It creates more spaciousness and also more light exposure, as well as water availability on the forest floor, which creates more opportunity for the flora to thrive. So you can get more flowering plants and shrubs that then also add value to wildlife mm-hmm. so that they can thrive in that area as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm. So I did watch a video of one of the prescribed burn videos, and Val Lopez from the Amamutsun was talking about that, right? About, we'll come back to prescribed burns in a few minutes, but about, you know, thinning in the forest. And my question is, can you do that where there is housing, you know, around housing? I mean, people living up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, those who weren't burned out by the CZU fire last year, have told me that companies are coming in and sort of seem to be cutting trees down willy-nilly without any kind of clear, you know, clear plan. Some of them are to clear away from power lines, but others don't seem to have anything to do with it. And it's not really, you know, obvious that that's what's going on. So that seems like that would be an obstruction to doing this.
So actually, we burn off of the back porches or front porches of houses regularly in this field. And mm-hmm. it's one of the most important uses of fire that we can have nowadays when, you know, providing resilience against wildfire threats to homes is such a big deal. So it's actually not an inhibition necessarily to using fire to have houses in the intermix or interface, but it does mean that we need to be strategizing ways to make sure that those houses are resilient. So structure hardening is a really important piece of mm-hmm. houses that are going to be existing in the interface or intermix zones.
Yeah. The hot potato is, do you think people should be building and living at these interfaces? I don't know if you want to say anything about that.
I do not think that we should be, in general, continuing to develop in these interface and intermix zones. I do think there can be a valuable way of people living in those areas, in that if they are really deeply committed to stewardship and their uh-huh. putting of their house in that area is mindful and aware of what the fire risks are, how they're integrating their home into the landscape so that it fits with the reality of fire in California, as well as other ecosystem services. Those can be little havens for people to steward landscapes again, right? But it has to be done with that integrity and intention. Otherwise, we're just furthering the problem that we're all facing.
Yeah, I get that. So tell us about Fire Forward and Audubon Canyon Ranch.
Fire Forward is a prescribed burn capacity building program based out of the nonprofit nature conservation organization, Audubon Canyon Ranch. And we're focused in the North Bay, but reach pretty much the 9 county Bay Area county group. Mm-hmm. And I'm the founder and director of the program at the nonprofit. And it's been such a thrilling ride growing this program since 2017. When even just getting one prescribed burn on the ground using the permitting processes that made sense for that landscape was such a big deal and such a challenge, and we had so many hurdles we were facing. And now, just, you know, 4 years later, we're moving into training leaders in this community so that they can go teach others and train others. We're we're building this vibrant, vast community network of people who are coming together around this common cause to get more good fire on the ground. We're burning year round now, getting good fire on the ground year round for multitudes of ecosystem services.
Well, so let's back up a minute. You were the creator of the program at Audubon Canyon Ranch then?
Yes.
And how did you come to decide you wanted to do that, you know, and to, how did you convince the opera managers of the property that this was something that they wanted to do?
I had the good fortune of falling into Audubon Canyon Ranch initially as a resource ecologist in 2015. I was still finishing my PhD, but they hired me telling me that this is a position they had open, but they specifically were looking for someone who could take their existing fire management directive that they put together in 2012, saying that they wanted to fully approve prescribed burning as a practice on their preserves
because
they recognized the need for it and wanted to hire me to make it actually happen.
Got it.
So in 2017, we got the first prescribed burn done in May of that year at one of the preserves. And shortly thereafter, shortly before that, I had told the executive director that this is what I want to do for my life, and I want to make a difference, and we can do it. We're perfectly poised to do it. And I was lucky enough that the executive director at ACR and its board of directors all are forward thinking and know the importance of getting good fire on the ground and supported that.
Well, it's, I mean, and it's, but it's also unusual, I imagine, for someone who is so fresh off the PhD to actually be able to do something like that. It's quite admirable in that respect. Maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit more about prescribed burns, right? What they are, you know, and where you set them.
Sure. And I will say it's not all just been me. I've been really fortunate. ACR has an incredible team of really committed, like passionate people who want to make a difference. And that whole team has really made this possible. So prescribed burns are essentially planned ignitions that are being set with a prescription, hence the prescribed fire part, and to meet objectives. So we do a lot of site visits in my program to various landowners and properties around the region where people are wondering, okay, what kind of prescribed fire would make sense here or any at all? And there are so many different objectives that we try to meet with prescribed fire. One of those will be reducing fuels. In oak woodlands, it may also be reducing encroaching trees that are converting the oak woodland to something else, like a Douglas fir forest. We may burn to, you know, remove brush from coastal prairie. It's a rapidly degrading habitat that is exceptionally diverse and valuable. So if you don't frequently burn in coastal prairies or in oak woodlands, they rapidly degrade. They need that frequent low intensity fire. So we really look for ecosystems like that. Redwoods also in the North Bay area are adapted to burning about every 4 years, it looks like, from the fire history. Wow. And we've seen in a lot of the foggier, wetter parts of the North Bay where redwoods grow, that the litter and duff, so those dead materials that accumulate underneath redwoods, can stay flammable year round. So nowadays we're actually starting to burn off some of that a little bit at a time in the winter so that we're allowing those redwoods to be resilient against wildfire and to thrive and have other species in their understories. But with prescribed burning in general, we're burning with control lines as well. So we're burning under a weather prescription and under a prescription of how much moisture is in the fuel and whether our smoke will rise and carry away from communities or can we not burn because the smoke is going to stay where we are. So we use that prescription and then we use control lines. So usually bare mineral soil or road going around the area that we want to burn. We start burning at a high point generally. So if you think about a match and you hold it upright, If you hold it upright, the fire moves really slowly down the length of the match. But if you turn it upside down, fire races up the match and burns your fingers. So if we start at the high point, like at the top of the match, and carry fire slowly down the hill to the bottom of that area, we're able to moderate fire behavior, make sure it burns slow and low, and just does the work that we want it to do.
So that has to do with the physics of air circulation, as I think about it, right? Is that the fire is drawing air into the flame zone, right? And when it goes downhill, that's happening more quickly. I guess that would be the physics of it. I was just thinking about why that would be the case, but that's very interesting.
Yeah, it's partially that, and also a preheating effect that happens if you have the tip of the flame, which is the hottest part of the flame, leaning toward more fuel. You're preheating those fuels and allowing it to grow very quickly.
Okay. Well, that's really interesting. Do you seek out places to do these prescribed burns? Do people ask you to come and do them? How does that work?
We have, at this point, reached a really cool place to be where we have an ever-growing list of people who own or manage properties, or people who don't but have friends who do, reaching out to us saying, hey, we would love to see if we're a good place for a prescribed burn. Would you come check it out? And my team members, folks from my team will all go out, do a site visit, and see whether or not it's a good opportunity, do some advising with the landowner. In some cases, it's really well set up with control lines and a nice big area that we can burn during what's called fire season. So between May 1st and nowadays sometime around December, where we would get a permit from CAL FIRE and do it with a burn boss and use a very strict incident command system that comes from that federal paramilitary structure from fire suppression. Or in some cases nowadays, because of climate change and the lower amount of water that we're getting over the course of winter, we're doing some areas that are maybe don't have as great control lines, but do need some fire on the ground. We'll do some burning in winter outside of fire season, in between rainstorms, where we can go out with a drip torch and a backpack pump with the landowner and some neighbors and teach them how to do some really low risk, low intensity prescribed burning to get rid of some of those fuels in the middle of that winter window, much like a landowner would be able to go out and run a chainsaw on their own property. We're adding to that toolkit so that these landowners can do this work themselves.
Although that sounds to me as though, you know, with the chainsaw, the landowner can injure himself or herself, right? Whereas with the fire equipment, there's always the risk that it's going to jump or something like that. So landowners are permitted to do burns themselves if they, in the winter, if they so desire?
Yes. So the way the permitting works on private land is that during fire season, which it always starts to date, always starts on May 1st and has some ending roving date depending on when and how much water we're getting. During fire season, the landowner needs a permit from CAL FIRE because it's a burn ban, and you need to have a permit saying, okay, you're exempt from this ban because you have a great plan in place and you have everything you need to do this safely. Outside of fire season, though, a landowner can do that on their own property according to their own judgment. They still need an air quality permit or a smoke management plan, depending on where they are. But they have the right to do that burning on their own property.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, the role of my program is to make sure people are trained to do that diligently and correctly so that they don't hurt themselves or anyone else.
Okay, well, let's take a short break. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM on your radio dial and KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. Good afternoon. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz. Today, my guest is Dr. Sasha Berlman, wildland fire scientist. Dr. Berlman earned her PhD in wildland fire science from the University of California at Berkeley. She's currently director of Fire Forward at Audubon Canyon Ranch in Stinson Beach. Do you have to, the videos I saw, you were burning, there was burning of pasture going on. I mean, that was one of the, you know, one of the shots. And do you have to go back every year to burn?
Grasslands, the return interval can be really kind of anywhere from 2 to 5 years. Burning it every year, you may sometimes burn 2 years in a row to try to get rid of an invasive weed, but typically you need a little bit more thatch accumulation. So some more of the dead grass building up to carry fire well through that landscape. And you don't want to over hammer those grasses with fire. So usually a couple years in between for grasslands. And as you move into other ecosystems, that time window is a little bit longer.
So for example, can you give some examples of that?
Yeah, so an oak woodland could be anywhere from maybe 3 to 15 years. Redwoods could be kind of, like I said, anywhere from every 4 years to even up to 30 years, I think I've seen, depending on where you are and what you're looking at. And then, yeah, some of our forests are similar every 10 to 15 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm. But how widely is this being done then? I mean, I sort of get the impression, right, that this is still quite limited, doing prescribed burning.
It's rapidly growing, but we're definitely not doing enough. I would say, I think in the last year and a half, my program has been involved in 18 prescribed burns in the North Bay area, in mm-hmm. the Sonoma, Marin County regions, and a little bit of Mendocino. And I think we have another 35 projects at least looking for the rest of this next year.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot going on.
Are there other organizations and groups in the state that are doing this kind of work?
There are some great organizations across the state doing this work, including prescribed burn associations, which are the community networks of folks developing the skill set and doing it together, mm-hmm. popping up all over the place. And I should say here, this is probably a good place to say it, that the challenges we're facing in Northern California are pretty different from the challenges being faced in Southern California. Southern California has mostly had a challenge of having too much fire at too high a frequency, converting their chaparral into invaded grassland. So it's a pretty different environment down there. So most of this discussion pertains pretty much to Northern California mm-hmm. and a lot of the Sierras. But there's Mid-Klamath Watershed Council up in the Klamath has done this work for much longer than my program has been around, doing really great work. We have some other partners like the Watershed Training Center, who's also been really engaged in this work for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. So, and so you teach people how to do this, right? I mean, tell us about what a typical class is like in prescribed burning. I mean, I can imagine that, you know, people who like playing with fire might be attracted to this, but.
You know, it's been interesting. I think we've mostly had people who have recently been traumatized by wildfire.
Yeah, no, I would expect that, right?
Yeah, and they're wanting to come out and kind of heal that relationship and find a new way of interacting with fire, which is really neat. But it depends on kind of which aspect of the training we're doing. Sometimes we're teaching those federal wildland firefighting classes that are directly from that federal curriculum, because it gets people qualified to be on the fire line, make sure that they're developing the skill sets that they need to do this work within this modern context, essentially within the political framework and agency framework that we have. And then other times we're teaching workshops or just leading people on the fire line in direct practical experience with a coach that's showing them how to do things, what to do in what situation, what to worry about, what's not a concern.
That sounds a little risky though. You're right. You're taking people with no experience to the fire line and showing them what to do.
Most of the time we're training them first to a basic standard and then
bringing them out.
Uh-huh. But occasionally we are including people who don't have that is official training or qualification, And we're really careful about the way we fold them in. So we make sure we have lots of people who do have sufficient experience to lead and train others. And we pair people with who are newer with people who have that experience to lead them safely and well.
I got it, got it. What do people come away with? I mean, oh, I know before that, you mentioned this federal fire curriculum. Is that online? Is that available to look at? Or is it a restricted document to keep people from experimenting?
So the entry point for a lot of these people coming out is basic wildland firefighter, or in the federal system is known as firefighter type two. And that is a kind of a group of five courses that people take. And then they do a PAC test, which is a fitness test to make sure that their heart is okay for them to be on the fire line. And the way we teach that is actually it's 30 to 40 hours worth of online coursework offered through federal websites. And then they come out and do a one-day field day with us, where we do a review of all of the skills and make sure that they have all the hard skills that they need to be able to operate and know what someone's telling them to do on the fire line if they're yelled at from someone that they need to grab a particular tool or take some action. So some of it is available online as coursework you can take online, but it's not complete online. It
No, I
needs to be paired
understand.
with in-person things. But a lot of that curriculum is available to look at online. You may not get a course certificate because you haven't taken it, but National Wildfire Coordinating Group provides those documents and those curricula largely freely on the internet so that people can peruse those resources if they want to.
Now, here's a question. Did you have to do any actual firefighting as part of your dissertation work?
For my dissertation work, I did not. And it was actually a tough thing. I spent my entire PhD really wanting to get out on a hotshot crew because I felt like I was missing that piece terribly. And I just always had research work to do in the summers and couldn't make it happen, which is part of why as soon as I graduated from the PhD, I went out and got out on the crew.
Yeah, I'm just thinking that that's a that you know, if you're in biology, you do biological experiments in the lab, right? But in your case, you don't go out and do that kind of experiential learning, right? You know, as part of the
Yeah.
dissertation.
Well, I did do prescribed burning as part of my
Oh, you
dissertation.
did.
My
Oh, okay.
dissertation did require prescribed burns, and it actually made it incredibly frustrating to get through that dissertation because we were before this time where it was pretty, nowadays it's pretty easy to get a prescribed burn to happen, but at that time, even just a few years ago, it was ridiculously challenging to get a prescribed fire from the plan to the implementation. So I had multiple experiments and multiple years where it was a year of planning for this prescribed burn. My experiment was going to depend on this happening, and then it gets canceled. And I had to find a new experiment to do and a new prescribed burn to even just continue progressing in my research.
Oh, that's interesting. So you actually that was you were actually doing these experiments as part of your research.
Yeah.
That's interesting as well. Well, so we're obviously starting to enter, well, we're in the midst of fire season, I guess. I guess it's year round. All
Yeah.
right. And I'm sure that our listeners, at least some of our listeners, were burned out last year, some of them were not. So, two questions, I guess, is what should they do? Right? And how can they learn more? And are there courses or is there training in the Santa Cruz area, you know, prescribed burn training?
Ooh, good questions. So the first and foremost thing is I would say people should make sure their structures are hardened against fire.
What does that include?
That includes making sure you've got really fine mesh that's well connected going into your crawl space in your attic, making sure that if you have to evacuate for a fire, you don't have curtains that are flammable right up against your windows. Mm-hmm. Making sure you don't have a bunch of debris underneath an exposed wooden deck, and that your any wood on your house is sealed and in a way that is non-flammable. Things like that, your actual house. And then you work out from there and make sure you don't have flammable or half dead vegetation right up against your house. You should have a kind of a 5-foot zone of no flammable vegetation, no wood chips, things like that. And then go out from there and start practicing stewardship as you move away from the house. And then as another part of that, have an evacuation plan, have a go bag, be ready to go. That supports not just yourself and your neighborhood and your people, but firefighters as well, so that they're not like having to try to focus on evacuating people to create that safety, and evacuate early if you need to, rather than waiting until the last minute when you're forced to leave.
Yeah, most of these fire-prone areas, high-risk areas, don't have much in the way of access in or out.
Right.
So that makes it quite difficult. I just should mention the university, Santa Cruz has this long range development plan that it is, you know, presenting to the public, and part of it suggests expanding into the forest to the north of the existing campus.
Wow.
And last year the fire came about to within a mile of the campus, although I'm not sure it was to the built up part. Right. So egress from the upper part, from the there's not much, and so it's a troubling question here. The emergency evacuation plans are not terribly reassuring either. We need to take a short break. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM on your radio dial, and KSQD.org streaming on the internet. Good afternoon. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz. Today, my guest is Dr. Sasha Berlman, wildland fire scientist. Dr. Berlman earned her PhD in wildland fire science from the University of California at Berkeley. She's currently director of Fire Forward at Audubon Canyon Ranch in Stinson Beach. So let's continue. What else? I seem to remember, though, that it's recommended that people clear 100 feet around their house. Is that ideally, or is that, you know, some sort of requirement, or what?
I think that that's often misunderstood, and I'm glad we're getting to talk about it, because I've seen people take that 100 feet thing in fear of wildfire, completely remove every single tree, every single growing thing for 100 feet. And that's not actually going to be the difference between things going well and things going poorly, because often the shade that an old mature tree creates near your home is exceptionally valuable for reducing potential fire behavior around your home as well. So what you're looking to do with that 100 feet is reduce or remove completely dead material from vegetation. So get rid of the downed branches, dead leaves, all of like any bushes that are half dead or have a bunch of dead twigs buried within them because you've been using a hedge trimmer on it. Things like that, that's what you want to focus on. But you want to keep your green and live vegetation and keep mature, healthy, large trees so that you're creating that nice shaded habitat. So that's a really important part of that 100 foot clearing. It's not you're creating a parking lot. It's reduced fuels.
You know, and I read somewhere recently about not leaving trees, you know, cut down trees laying around, but chipping them. But you just mentioned that chips are flammable. And I know that up here in the mountains, there's a lot of chipping going on, and they're now big piles. I haven't seen them, but this is what I've heard. And so is there a contradiction there?
I think there is. People seem obsessed with chips, and it just seems to be like what people want to do with dead trees when they have them, even post wildfire. But from what I've seen in the fires in the last 5 years is that those chips are not decomposing. We do not get enough water in our winter seasons these days for those chips to decompose. And they are absolutely contributing to high heat and wildfire around areas that they're being laid. So I've seen chicken coops or like chicken yards where the only reason every single chicken burns in a wildfire is because they use wood chips as the substrate under the chicken yard. I've seen entire orchards completely nuked by wildfire because of wood chips. I've seen wood chips cause houses to burn. I've seen piles of wood chips that have not been spread out yet burn for 7 days straight at temperatures where you can't come within 15 feet of the pile because the pile's putting off so much heat.
Well, that's like making charcoal, isn't it, basically?
Yeah, exactly. So it seems like it would be a good solution. And I think historically it would have been because we had more water in our winters and more consistent water so they could decompose and break down. But that's not what we're seeing now. And we are seeing those contribute to pretty negative, serious negative outcomes from wildfire.
Okay. So, and then I had to ask about, you know, if people want to get the training, prescribed burn training, what should they do? Where can they go?
So, people are definitely welcome to check out our website, fireforward.org. And there's a resource panel on the right-hand side that includes frequently asked questions and all of that. And they can find out about when we're offering more trainings. We've definitely had people from the Santa Cruz area come out here for that. There's also, I believe now, a Central Coast Prescribed Burn Association that's standing up. So there may be ways to get involved with the Central Coast Prescribed Burn Association. And then, I think consume content, right? So check out these opportunities. If people are looking for jobs, there are more jobs coming up in this world than ever before. There are lots of different ways to get involved, but fireforward.org should be at least a good starting point that I can speak to.
Well, that's okay. That's great. Well, we're almost out of time. Are there any topics that we didn't cover that you might want to address? Don't say no, because we do have 5 minutes. And so,
I would just encourage people to see this whole picture, that we're not only using fire to reduce fuels, to reduce wildfire risk, but that fire is a necessary part of these ecosystems and our lives here. And our ecosystems depend on us stewarding them with fire to thrive and to be resilient in the face of climate change and drought and disease and pests. So there's a really hopeful message there in that we are a critical, necessary part of these ecosystems and have an important role to play and a responsibility to these ecosystems if we're going to choose to live here. So while these wildfires are having really tragic impacts and effects right now, we can look to a much better future by taking that responsibility on and seeing this as a part of everyone's existence here and responsibility as a community.
Yeah, and I guess as we experience climate change and possibly less rainfall, right, actually using fire then becomes more and more important in order to prevent it, you know, out of control wildfires, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's, you know.
And there's a really neat, almost, I don't know if paradox is the right word here, but a neat relationship where using more prescribed fire actually can increase water yield and water availability and decrease the impacts of drought. So really we're using fire for the benefit of water as well.
Well, how does that work?
If you have fewer drought stress trees competing for water on the landscape and you're only keeping the better spaced, happy, healthy trees on the landscape, you end up with more water availability
in the soil, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's more is percolating into the soil and keeping it damp or damper than it would be otherwise.
Yeah.
It's also quite interesting. Well, we're close to the end, And it's been a really wonderful conversation. I think I've learned a lot. I hope our listeners have learned a lot. And I want to thank you, Sasha Berlman, for being my guest on Sustainability Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, and wish you luck with this entire endeavor. I mean, it's a lifetime of doing this, right? That's quite impressive. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
If you'd like to learn more about Sasha's work or about Audubon Canyon Ranch and the instruction and training that they provide, you can go to the ranch's website at egret.org. As a reminder, shows from the 5 to 6 p.m. Sunday slot are rebroadcast the following Tuesday mornings from 6 to 7 a.m. And if you'd like to listen to previous shows, you can find them at ksqd.org/sustainabilitynow and Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Pocket Casts, among other podcast sites. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make KSQD your community radio station, including Christine Barrington, who was engineer for this show. And so, until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
The more it will take.